Well, good morning, everyone. And as you can see, Senator Kerry, it's packed. We're very, very eager to hear what you have to say, what you will share with us. Let me not take much time, but maybe just make 3 points that I would personally really like to make about Senator Kerry, whom everybody, of course, has followed for years. There's no need for an introduction. But 3 points. One, I think, Senator Kerry, you know conflict, you know about war, you know that sometimes it's necessary, but if you can avoid it, the gift to humanity of being able to avoid it is huge. And in many of your speeches and what you've shared with the world, that message comes through very strongly, and I think that's one very, very important message. And therefore, if diplomacy and development can avoid conflict, can avoid loss of life, there are few things that are more important than that. You've also championed the fight against disease, championed two major legislative efforts in the year 2000 and 2002, AIDS, tuberculosis relief, malaria, and I do believe that results are there. I mean, this is one area where the U.S. has made a big difference, where the efforts of the U.S. has made a big difference, and Senator Kerry was one of the leaders of that effort. And finally, in dear to my heart also very much, the whole environment, climate issue. It's going to be with us, this whole issue, for the next few years. The League of Conservation Voters considers you a champion of the environment, and I do know, and I do hope that the efforts to fight climate change, to fight for a better environment worldwide, which is another issue that brings the whole of humanity together, are very dear to your heart. So I just wanted to make these 3 points. Thank you very much on behalf of Brookings for being with us, and give you the floor.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Kamal, very, very much. Thank you for the introduction. You made only one mistake in it, and that's when you said that he doesn't need an introduction. I've never met anybody in elected life who doesn't need their introduction. But that aside, I'm greatly appreciative, and let me just say to all of you that our thoughts are very, very much with Strobe Talbott and the extended family of Brookings, and I want to express on behalf of all of us in the Senate our condolences for his loss and Brookings's loss. Brooke Shearer fought a long and graceful, difficult struggle, and our thoughts are with him. Also, Kamal, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to Washington after the important stints that you have performed as Turkey's finance minister and head of the United Nations Development Program. You know these issues, you know them well, and your contributions to this discussion are going to be, needless to say, will continue to be critical. And those of you here at Brookings know very well the critical role that Kamal played in turning around the Turkish economy. And his efforts are frankly still bearing fruit there today. So it's an honor for me to be introduced by you and to be here at Brookings with you, sir. 65 years ago, Secretary of State George Marshall looked out at a Europe that was in ruins. You have to think about the full extent of those ruins and the state of mind of people at the end of a war. Germany had lost 90% of its railways. 1 in 5 houses in France was destroyed. Nations were on the verge of bankruptcy. Currencies were collapsing. And in many places, people were literally starving. The success of Marshall's response has become one of the foundational narratives of American foreign policy. Understanding that isolation was no longer a choice, Marshall led America's efforts to rebuild a Europe that was to become a Europe full of strong allies. And a group of nations who are ready to join in the institutions and the alliances of a new world order. In other words, George Marshall, one person, had a vision, a big vision, and he offered it at a critical moment. Over time, Marshall's Economic Cooperation Administration grew into the U.S. Agency for International Development and a legacy of vigorous diplomacy and effective developmental assistance was born out of it. Our scientists helped to spark an agricultural revolution that ended a vicious cycle of famine and starvation in dozens of countries. Our investment and aid paved the way for the East Asian economic miracle. Our aid workers served on the front lines of countless humanitarian responses, from earthquake relief to tsunami assistance. America's strong tradition of diplomacy and development is, in fact, and should be, a point of pride. And I think many of us today feel it, while too many Americans are completely unaware of it. I saw firsthand, at a very young age, what we had accomplished when my father moved our family to Berlin in the early 1950s to take on a new posting then as the legal advisor to the High Commissioner of Germany, then James Conant. Even as a 12-year-old, I became aware of post-war reconstruction efforts. Walking into a building in downtown Berlin, I couldn't miss a plaque that declared for all to see this building was rebuilt with help from the Marshall Plan. And that, of course, stood for America. When we invoke the Marshall Plan today, it's tempting to draw the easy conclusion that simply by sending more people and more money overseas, you're going to somehow replicate its successes. That misses the point. Marshall's true genius was, at least in my judgment, in the way in which he saw clearly the challenges of that particular moment. And he saw just as clearly the world that he hoped to create. And then he reached into government in order to empower and even invent the institutions that could make it happen. This was transformational diplomacy before the phrase became fashionable. And with one key difference, Marshall actually matched his rhetoric with resources and it delivered results. Simply put, we've got a gap today between our rhetoric and what we commit. We have a gap between our rhetoric and even our values and the understanding of Americans about those values and about what we get for these kinds of efforts. Simply put, my friends, what we need today is what Marshall offered back then, a strategic vision for diplomacy and development that will carry us forward to meet a new generation of challenges, a broad array of challenges, ethnic tensions, religious extremism, ideological excesses, all of which present problems in many ways far more complex than those that Marshall faced, but no less immediate and urgent. It's no secret that American foreign policy has today reached a moment of multiple crises. Two ongoing wars, a non-proliferation regime that's under severe strain, a financial crisis whose full and global implications are still unfolding, a global counterinsurgency against Al-Qaeda and others that cannot be won with guns and bombs alone. Growing poverty, population disenfranchisement, desertification and decline of natural resources, the decimation of them in many places, punctuated by global climate change. Our challenges, without exaggeration, are beyond anything that we have ever faced. But there are clear paths forward. I'm actually extraordinarily optimistic because I see the possibilities for how we can deal with each of these if we summon the political will and put together the global effort to do it. What we need to do is reach now new understandings with the developing countries like China and India and get low-carbon technologies into the hands of billions of people. We know that's an imperative. We need to find new ways to cooperate on problems like global finance and pandemic disease that by their very nature require a multifaceted international response. And indeed, Bill Frist and I wrote the first legislation that we actually got Jesse Helms to support that became the Global AIDS Initiative that ultimately President Bush translated into PEPFAR. We've seen the differences that that can make. We need to achieve the full Millennium Development Goals and make real progress against the extreme poverty and gender inequality and AIDS and infant mortality that consume and ravage developing nations across the planet. And we need to find ways to bolster allies who risk losing their people to radicals in places like the West Bank, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, and who frankly risk it perhaps even more because of the kind of strange passive indifference of countries that talk about the problem but don't put the resources there. I'll just give you a quick example. I was in the Middle East over the weekend, and I was at the World Economic Forum, met with King Abdullah and others, and you just can't help but see how real and palpable the negative impact is of all of the rhetoric about ultimately building a legitimate partner for peace in the West Bank and the complete indifference of most of the Western world and many of the Arab countries to the effort to really do that over the last 5 years. So what we need to do, my friends, as we look at each of these challenges, is be as practical as George Marshall was. We have skyrocketing youth populations in states and economies that are essentially broken. There are millions of kids under the age of 18, 60% in Saudi Arabia, perhaps 60% in Jordan, 60% almost in Egypt, and you can run the list, where they grow up disenfranchised, without adequate education, in many cases without any education, full of resentment, and susceptible to the influence of radical extremism, susceptible just almost to anything that supplants the absence of adequate governance to somehow have a positive impact on their lives. At a moment when the distance between what happens over there and here and its impact over here is shorter than at any time than it's been, this is an urgent concern. To make matters worse, many observe, and many have observed publicly, that these challenges are growing, not diminishing. Events like today's global financial crisis and last year's global food crisis are just signposts along the road, pointing toward a rapidly changing, increasingly unpredictable global order, one that is defined by dynamism, but also by precariousness. So going forward, we need to summon the will. It comes from leadership. It comes from the grassroots, too. But we need to summon the will and create the mechanisms to deal with this multipolar world. I'm not going to go into all the science of climate change here, but suffice it to say that the science is coming back at us at a rate that is faster than and with negative implications greater than all the predictions that have been made by the best scientists of the world. It's coming at us faster with greater danger signs. And suffice it to say, the evidence is overwhelming that we also now need to prepare ourselves for the mass dislocations and natural disasters of catastrophic climate events, as well as the frightening resource scarcities caused by a global population projected to surge by 1.5 billion people over the next decade and a half. So these realities really do present a brave new world for which we have to dramatically redesign our foreign policy. If we are to meet these challenges, this much is clear. Development and diplomacy have to retake their rightful place alongside defense at the heart of American foreign policy. And yet today, for all of our past successes, there is a growing realization that our diplomatic and development capacities are simply not prepared for the task ahead. And when you consider our meager investment in it, it's easy to understand why. We have voted repeatedly with our dollars to bolster our defense institutions while completely neglecting our civilian capacity. Ladies and gentlemen, that has to change. Funding for the Department of Defense is over $500 billion. While despite recent increases, our international affairs budget remains just 0.35% of GDP. And this rounding error, and that's what it is, it's a rounding error in our overall budget funds, that particular 0.35% funds all the State Department operations, all of our foreign aid, all of our foreign policy programs, all of our diplomatic programs, all of our global health initiatives on HIV/AIDS, as well as humanitarian assistance and our efforts to help stabilize fragile states, reduce global poverty, and assist refugees. It's an insult to common sense. Last year, the Army added about 7,000 soldiers. That is more people than the entire American Foreign Service has in all. 1,100 Foreign Service officers could be hired for the cost of one single C-17 military cargo plane. Now, we've done the right thing for our military. I'm not suggesting that we don't have to, in this world of conflict and multiple locations, have a strong military. Obviously, we do. I believe that. And fully funding their budget requests, providing training, equipment, offering unequivocal support for their tasks and missions is important. And that's as it ought to be. But it's also time that we did what we need to do in our longer-term strategic interests with respect to the civilian side, too. Our diplomats, like our soldiers, have been achieving remarkable results, often with minimal support and often under the most dangerous of circumstances. In my trips to crisis areas, war zones, refugee camps, and some of the poorest countries on Earth, I've been amazed to see the depth of their resourcefulness and commitment. Just last weekend, I met a control officer named Gabriel Escobar, who is leaving behind the life of a major European capital in order to join voluntarily a reconstruction team in Kirkuk, one of the most dangerous cities in Iraq. A few months ago in Peshawar, I met Stacia George, a USAID officer who was literally on the front lines of our war against al-Qaeda in the federally administered tribal areas, dangerous place, learning the local culture, using development assistance to win the hearts and minds in a key battleground. And I truly believe that she was contributing and is contributing significantly to America's security, but could do so much more. These remarkably dedicated people are without question the unsung heroes of American foreign policy. And folks, to live up to our responsibility, we've got to make sure that we give them the resources so that they need in order to deliver on their talent. Today's imbalance between our military and civilian capabilities actually places undue burdens on our soldiers, too. A lot of people don't sort of see that connection. But often the soldiers are left behind to pick up the slack, distracted from a military function for which they were in fact trained. They are over-deployed as a consequence, picking up functions traditionally reserved for highly trained civilians because we haven't taken time to train enough of those civilians and to deploy them. In the early days of the Iraq War, we had soldiers building sewage systems, handing out small enterprise loans, and broadly engaging as mayors, police chiefs, and judges in a community. In Afghanistan, as one article put it, we're asking our soldiers to be combatants, cultural anthropologists, hearts and minds winners, and then combatants again. Frankly, it's a remarkable feat that they do accomplish when they accomplish it with incredible courage and competence. But they need the help of a civilian capacity that is multi-nation, multilateral civilian capacity, where there are experts in reconstruction communities and winning the peace, and where you have more than one country on the ground or more than two or three putting their stake in these values that are represented in those endeavors. The Secretary of State, as we know, is the nation's chief foreign policy officer reporting to the President. But she is operating today with a remarkable imbalance that has been institutionalized. Choices on military assistance and arms exports are fundamental to our diplomacy. And going forward, the State Department needs the people, the tools, the authority to manage this aspect of our foreign policy as well as the other missions. Now, this challenge is not new. It predates the past administration, even, and it stretches beyond party lines. Even those leaders who have recognized the problem have actually failed to marshal the resources to solve it. All of which begs the question, how do we finally strengthen our civilian institutions to adequately address the challenges of the 21st century that we understand and that I have addressed? Well, there's a long-term answer and there's a short-term answer. Over the long term, we need to take a close, hard look at exactly what we want our diplomatic and development institutions to achieve. We need to define the mission with greater clarity, and we need to understand its limits and also its possibilities. And we need to make sure that we give those people the resources they need to get where we have decided they must go. We must also undertake a full strategic review. Assess strengths, weaknesses, map out the options, consider their implications, and determine what is in the best interests of the agencies and the country itself. But we can't afford to wait to put this grand vision and this larger institutional capacity to work. We've got to do it now. Our growing and gathering challenges do not allow us, they just don't afford us the luxury of not recalibrating quickly. In the short term, there are urgent reforms and actions that we should undertake to offer more immediate help for U.S. diplomats and development professionals who serve on the front lines around the world. Turning first to the diplomatic corps, we need to rebuild the basic capabilities in three key areas. First, we need more resources and more personnel. Having too few diplomats means that we lose opportunities that constantly fall through the cracks. I've been to Hong Kong, listened to the Foreign Commercial Service people say, there are only three of us here. We can't keep up with all the other countries who are responding to the RFPs from countries for business. We lose hundreds of thousands of jobs because we don't even adequately resource our ability to sell our business and to help our businesses sell their goods. It also overstretches our existing corps and prevents them from investing the time to develop the skills that we need going forward. I'm pleased that the President has committed to hiring 1,500 new officers over the next 2 years because there's simply no substitute for smart, well-trained, and capable Foreign Service officers on the ground. But let me tell you something. That is just a beginning, a small down payment on the kind of work we need to do in country after country. Second, we need to make sure that our diplomats have the training, the education, and the support that they need. We still have an enormous language gap in this country. It is shocking to me the numbers of people in the United States who can't handle a second language. Now, that's changing because of demographics. In the Foreign Service, obviously, we have a great training program, and there are far and few between who don't speak several languages. But we need more people in more slots, not just FSOs, who have that kind of ability. And we need to encourage those Foreign Service officers to take rotations at other agencies and to be in details at international organizations so we can work with them to do a better job and be represented. We must ensure that America has high-performance, high-quality embassies. In too many places, I've seen fortress-like embassies that present a foreboding and hostile face of America to the world. I think we need embassies that meet modern security requirements, but you don't have to undercut the image of America that we hope to portray in the building of them. A third priority is to build a more responsible, flexible department itself. We need an organization nimble enough to quickly respond to emerging situations, move personnel, move material promptly to address an emerging crisis on the ground. And while our staff security is paramount, particularly in certain places today, we also have to give them the freedom to be able to go out and do their work. There's a balance there. I understand that. But it has its risks. And we have to accept some of those risks in the interests of the initiative that can be put into place by some very creative people on the ground. The setting for today, I guess this is a complete diversion, but just, you know, all you have to do is go read Three Cups of Tea and see what Greg Mortensen did in Pakistan with schools in Afghanistan and get a pretty good understanding of how you can counter risk through relationships and through the indigenous protection that comes because people say you're with them, not against them. And there's a whole discussion that could be had around that. The setting for today's diplomacy is very different than it has been in the past. The Department of the future has to be equipped to operate as George Marshall did in a Paris and Berlin, but I'll tell you what, much of our work is going to be done in places like Beijing, Baghdad, Kabul, Islamabad, and a lot of other places, many more troubled than those that I mentioned. There are also immediate steps that we have to take to rebuild USAID and other foreign assistance programs. I know a topic of great concern here in Washington, and it should be. We need to clarify the policies and the goals of our foreign assistance. There is no overarching policy for U.S. foreign aid today or for development today. By one count, the Foreign Assistance Act actually lists over 150 policy directives and goals. And when you prioritize everything, folks, as you know, then nothing is a priority. Dramatically paring down that list and focusing on the ways we deal with today's global challenge, it will dramatically change the possibility of strengthening the focus and the impact of our programs. Second, we need to bring greater coordination to those aid efforts. We have over 20 agencies implementing a slew of aid programs, often with very diffuse and even conflicting goals. Right now, while 60% of our foreign aid goes to 10 countries, get that, 60% of our foreign aid to 10 countries for political, military, counter-narcotics, and HIV AIDS, the other 40% is spread thin in 140-plus countries. Obviously, I think it's obvious, we need a more balanced approach. And part of the balance will come by committing adequate resources so you're not playing the spread thing, rob Peter to pay Paul program that we've been stuck with. So we need the balanced, comprehensive development strategy to determine which agency is in charge, what we hope to achieve, and how to best accomplish our goals. Third, we must strengthen our professional expertise and capacity in the delivery of aid. The need has never been greater to train and cultivate a generation of highly skilled public servants. We need agriculture experts who can plant bug-resistant crops and foster a second green revolution in Africa. We need scientists who can develop new vaccines and public health workers who can train people to deliver them to places that have never seen an American before. We need engineers who can help the poorest countries in the world find clean development pathways and adapt to a changing climate. To attract top talent, we need to promote a results-based culture of accountability and transparency, and we need to restore intellectual capacity and policy and strategic planning to ensure that USAID is a place where innovative ideas can take shape and take hold. Fourth, we need to streamline outdated laws and heavy bureaucracy in order to untie the hands of workers. The last time the United States Senate authorized the Foreign Assistance Act was the year I arrived in the Senate in 1985. That bill runs over 400 pages long and is full of confusing directives, reporting requirements, and procedural roadblocks. We need to ease those burdens so that the missions and those on those missions can get the job done. I intend to work with the administration over the next days to revisit the Foreign Assistance Act in this year. Fifth, we must rebalance the relationship between Washington and the field. Recent reforms have kept most of the funding and policy decisions here in Washington, and they undermine the primacy of the field. While this helps with bureaucratic coordination, It actually cuts out the expertise of those who are living on the ground, who have specialized knowledge of cultures, problems, and possibilities. And to do that is really just to cut off our nose to spite our face. We need to empower country teams to shape programs, to determine needs, and even take calculated risks if they see a real strategic opportunity. We're very fortunate to have a new administration that understands the challenges that we face in the world today and that I believe is committed to meeting these by reforming these institutions I've talked about. Congress obviously has a constitutional responsibility and the legislative authority to get this done. If Congress had been looked upon as simply a check writer in this process, that's part of our own fault. We've embraced an expanded budget and expanded appropriations process at the expense of valuable means of oversight and policymaking. Aside from the Armed Services Committee, which passes annual defense authorization bills, the authorizing committees of the United States Congress have basically gone out of business of legislating. And this is a worrisome trend. The primary role of authorizing committees, like mine, is to provide policy guidance and expertise and to help shape the scope and direction and intent of our agencies. That's where they're supposed to spend their time. That's why you're supposed to serve on the committee, to understand those issues and not leave it simply to the appropriations process and to others who don't necessarily have the expertise. That's why I intend to be asking Senator Lugar to join me in introducing two new pieces of legislation. One, a Foreign Affairs Authorization Act that will authorize the State Department and related accounts, and an initial foreign aid reform bill. That's the two pieces, the foreign aid bill and the other. Neither piece of legislating is going to bring a comprehensive reform all at once, and I think you understand that. But you know what they will do? They will initiate a reform process and begin laying the groundwork and providing a blueprint for the diplomacy and for the developmental institutions that we need. The Foreign Affairs Authorization Act is crucial to our larger goals here. When we pledge to restore diplomatic capacity, authorizing appropriate resources to do it is proof of our seriousness. There isn't a nation or a leader there's a nation I visited or a leader I've talked to who doesn't watch this closely and doesn't understand and read the messages closely. They know exactly where they stand in the pecking order of concern, and it affects their choices. In partnership with the administration, I intend to use the bill I talked about to bring us to several critical steps closer to creating the strong Department of State that we need. Increasing the size, education, and training of the diplomatic corps will be a top priority in this effort. We will also take a hard look at our diplomatic posture abroad and consider creative and efficient ways to make our embassies less imposing and also more environmentally sustainable. I plan to work closely with my colleagues in the House of Representatives, particularly Chairman Berman, in moving this legislation forward. We have not successfully passed a State Department authorization bill since 2002. I think it's time to end that and do what we need to do to define and take responsibility, really, for the direction that we're heading in. Passing a foreign aid reform bill will also be crucial to revitalizing the developmental agencies I've talked about. One of the top priorities will be to reestablish policy, intellectual, strategic capacity in our foreign aid programs. For too long, we have delegated the development and leadership and innovation to others. We need cutting-edge programs that push the envelope on ending global poverty and other problems, and our development agencies ought to be leading the charge in that effort. We also need to fight to hire and develop top talent. Another priority is going to be to develop a modern personnel system that will allow us to hire that top talent, to train them in the most advanced practices and techniques, and to provide more flexible rotations and improved career development possibilities so we hold on to them. And we also can't expect to hire top-notch professionals away from the private sector, folks, if we don't pay them a reasonable wage. And we need to make that part of this reform effort. Finally, we all share the notion that we ought to be in the business of funding development programs that actually work. To that end, we are going to support efforts in legislation to promote the accountability, to enhance transparency, to track performance with benchmarks or otherwise, and to distill the lessons that have been learned in a more comprehensive, institutionalized way, so that's not haphazard when you're recommitting the next error and suddenly someone comes in and you say, oh God, we got to look at what we did. But there's an ongoing process by which those evaluations are being made and you institutionalize the input of the previous efforts. These legislative efforts, I believe, can be a precursor to a much larger, more comprehensive rewrite of the Foreign Assistance Act next year. And we're going to need the cooperation of the administration, needless to say, to engage in this. When John F. Kennedy spoke at the founding of USAID in 1961, he articulated a basic truth about foreign policy. He said, we can't escape our moral obligation to be a wise leader in the community of nations. And Kennedy warned, and I quote, to fail to meet those obligations now would be disastrous and in the long run more expensive. He was talking about facing communism at that time. Well, for widespread poverty and chaos, which lead to collapse of existing political and social structures, which would inevitably invite the advance of totalitarianism into every weak and unstable area, that's what Kennedy warned us about. Thus, our own security, he said, would be endangered and our prosperity imperiled. Well, just substitute violent religious extremism and the current insurgencies across the world for totalitarianism, and the quote is as accurate today as it was then. Just as we did in Marshall's time and Kennedy's time, America today has a chance to return to a foreign policy that is not just seen by people everywhere, but is actually felt and lived by people everywhere. One that translates the rhetoric into real values on the ground and real progress on the ground, and thusly earns the respect of people because we do keep our word. The good news is that just as we rebuild our civilian institutions, there are going to be extraordinary chances to lead in the process. We are living in the moment of volatility that I described earlier, but let me tell you emphatically and with optimism, this is a moment of enormous possibility for global cooperation, for the transformation of our economies, and for dealing with issues that aren't rocket science in their demands for resolution. They are mostly a challenge to political will and to leadership. I believe we can drop infant mortality rates. They dropped 27% worldwide since 1990. By 2015, we should set a goal that we're going to cut the under 5 mortality by 2/3. Life expectancy is now 8 years higher than it was in 1990. Well, we can do better, and we know that, by cutting hunger and poverty in half by 2015, reversing the spread of HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other major diseases. Primary school enrollment has increased by 10%. It's time we made it universal. And while we're at, and that incidentally is the only way ultimately to deal with the challenge of disenfranchisement and extremism and what we see in so many countries and so many parts of the world. And while we're at it, and while we're engaging in this effort to have this universal effort for education, we need to eliminate gender disparity once and for all. As a proud father of two daughters, let me tell you, no child anywhere ought to be denied the right to learn just because she's a girl. And that challenge in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other parts of the world remains paramount. History teaches us that America is safest and America is strongest when we understand that our security will not be protected by guns and bombs or military alone. It has to be protected by our generosity, by our example, by our powerful outreach, by instilling a palpable sense in the people of the world that we understand and share in their destiny. That has always inspired people, and it will in the future. It undercuts our enemies, it empowers our friends, it keeps us safer. And this is the opportunity that we're looking at today, folks, and I hope that we're going to come together with an unparalleled sense of the possibilities and destiny and make this happen. Thank you. Yes.
I think you said you preferred that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'd be delighted. I gather we have time for a little bit of Q&A, and I'm happy to do a little bit of Q&A. Yes, sir. Yeah, right there. I think you were the first to pop your hand up. Just identify yourself. Tell us
what
subversive agency you're with, and we'll... No,
my name's Andrew Green. I was formerly a senior democracy fellow at the DG office at USAID.
I couldn't hear. Can you hold it closer?
Yeah. Formerly a senior democracy fellow at USAID's DG office. Now I'm in consulting. As the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and as a deep expert in foreign policy, could you please lay out for us your views on the role of democracy and human rights in U.S. development assistance? In other words, how does democracy and human rights fit into the world that you would like to see? And I'm asking because there are, a flurry of reform proposals out there. But 2 days ago, the Security Studies Group at the Center for American Progress released a global development strategy that calls for the intentional exclusion of democracy and human rights from development strategy, with the rationale that the form of government doesn't matter for economic development.
Well, that's a central and very tough question, which has to be approached, I think, without emotion, though human rights are emotional. And the plight of many people in the world obviously is horrendous and unacceptable and a challenge to all of us. But I think we have to be a little more mature, frankly, in some ways, as we think about what to press when, how to press certain things. Democracy and human rights are in the American DNA. It will never be absent from our dialogue. It should never be absent from our diplomacy. Neither issue should take a backseat in terms of defining who we are as Americans and as we engage with countries. It has to always be part of the discussion. I have never sat with any president or prime minister or leader of any country, no matter how friendly we are and no matter how much we're pushing, where if there is a human rights issue, I haven't raised it. In Syria recently, I talked with President Assad as we made great progress on a lot of issues about the Damascus 12 and about Riyadh, who is in jail and so forth, and likewise with China and others. But there has to be a balance. You can't deal with everything always all at the same time. You just can't. And we've made grave mistakes because sometimes we've put the cart ahead of the horse. I'll give you an example. In the elections in the West Bank in 2005, the Palestinians warned us many times and said, we're really not ready for an election. We shouldn't have one right now. The Israelis warned us many times and said, we're not ready for an election. This is not the time. If you have an election, Hamas is going to win. And it was really the insistence of the Bush administration, insistence that the election go forward, that brought about an election that indeed resulted in Hamas being elected. Now, if you're okay with elections and you're okay with accepting the results, then maybe that's one thing. But then the administration turned around and basically ignored the election, nullified it, and we are where we are today. So you got to make choices, and you've got to be smart about how you do it. Now, do I believe there should be a report that comes out that absolutely and totally separates it? No. I think there are moments where your aid program or economic development program will clearly be integrated into and have some bearing on whatever the whatever events have occurred in that country. There'd been a coup immediately a moment ago, and democracy had been trampled on, or if there'd been a massacre of protesters or people been thrown in jail or so forth, it'd be very difficult to say we ought to go invest a whole bunch of money and do this or that. On the other hand, there are countries where we could make enormous progress where there may be some institutional conflicts with respect to human rights or democracy. There are. I mean, China, you could run around the country, world, and we deal with them. But where the developmental programs and the aid programs are in fact doing more to advance a transformation than a direct confrontation on that particular issue. So I think you got to be, I'm not for hard, fast, you know, prophylactic rules here that say it's only this, it's only that. I think you have to exercise wisdom, judgment, discretion, and take each situation as it comes along, and that's the way I think you're going to have a far more effective policy. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Eckert of Reuters News Agency. I was struck by a point in your committee hearing last week with Envoy Richard Holbrooke on Pakistan about the need to get out in front in the information war with the Taliban and your legislative efforts under the Kerry-Lugar bill to do that. And I wonder if you could expound on the aims in that specific theater, as well as more broadly, say, in the Islamic world. Public diplomacy is part of your goals.
Well, public diplomacy, public diplomacy is a central. It's one of the top priorities, major priorities of diplomacy. And we have not pursued it very carefully or effectively. We haven't thought through often the kinds of language that we use. We haven't thought through sometimes the particular program, like an aid program or something else, that we engage in a particular place. We've never really prioritized the, you know, how we are going to reach large segments of a population or large populations and speak to them directly and or even counter the propaganda slash impact of wholly owned, state-owned outlets and so forth. I think we can do a far more effective job. The fact is that the Voice of America for many, many years did a brilliant job. I mean, if you listen to Vaclav Havel or you listen to other people talk about what brought them to freedom and to the risk-taking they came to, they listened to Voice of America. And for many years, Voice of America had the reputation of being a trustworthy news outlet. It lost that. It became overly politicized, propagandized, et cetera, too much an outlet of the government, and it lost that ability to connect to people to some degree. And now, of course, there are a whole bunch of different ways in which people get their information. But BBC, CNN, other things have replaced that in many parts of the world. But there are a lot of parts of the world where we have no message at all reaching people. None. And we don't even try. I'll give you the classic example in the context of what Dick Holbrooke was talking about. There are about 140 FM stations out in the western part of Pakistan, in the northwest province and in the Fatah, many of which are on the back of a motorcycle or in a car or, you know, a small shop. And they're broadcasting. And what they do is they broadcast fear. They literally announce on these stations who's going to be beheaded, or they will announce and then they do it. Or they're going to announce who, if they don't change something by the next day, will be punished by the court, and the behavior changes, and everybody's terrified. They either pack up and leave or some other alternative. That's communication. They are circulating videos of people being beheaded. You can buy one for $1 in western Pakistan and watch some poor soul, you know, be beheaded. And they use this as an instrument of fear. We've had nothing. And the government of Pakistan, incidentally, has had nothing coming in to counter that. So what we're talking about, it will be different in different places. It has to come from different sources in different places. The most important thing is to build up credibility about truth-telling and about, you know, to have alternative means of having news reach people, and we need to put a large effort into that together with other moderate Arab countries, with others in Western Europe and so forth. Now, that said, we also need to do a better job of deciding sort of how we approach the Muslim world. I have long believed, I've engaged in this actually. Last year I had the privilege of giving a speech at Yale Divinity School with Tony Blair at the invitation of the folks there who were hosting a conference with about 70 mullahs, imams, clerics, muftis from around the Mideast and other parts of the world actually, from the Far East also, who came to New Haven for a five-day conference together with 70 evangelicals from America. So you had Dr. Robert Shiller sitting there and a bunch of theologians. And what I talked about was the commonality of the Abrahamic faiths and the linkages that we never hear about. And we need to do a better job of communicating to Islam, to Muslims around the world. We need to empower moderates to be able to reclaim the legitimate religion, not the hijacked one that you see in its extreme application by the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but the legitimate one. And obviously one of the problems is within Islam, there's no one figure like there is in the Catholic Church. You have a whole bunch of different people issuing fatwas for different reasons, and there's not the same stream of accountability. We have to communicate better. We have to empower many of those moderate leaders. They're engaged. King Abdullah of Jordan, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia have been leading an effort on an interfaith dialogue. They had a very important conference in Mecca, another important conference in Spain. If you go back a year ago and read a sermon given by the cleric at Mecca as a result of that in the last days of the Hajj, you will read a very powerful statement from a Muslim leader about tolerance and about pluralism and coexistence and so forth. So our diplomacy has literally, we just didn't do that. The last 8 years it's been do this or else, my way or the highway. And of course the implications of what we did in Iraq are profound. I cannot tell you how many people I've heard from in the region who tell me their lives have been turned topsy-turvy as a consequence of America's ignorant and arrogant dislocation of a balance that existed between Shia and Sunni and now has been topsy-turvy. And Iran is stronger today as a consequence of that, so we're less trusted. All of these things, this is what public diplomacy is about. How do you address those perceptions and speak more directly to people's needs and concerns and perceptions? I believe that Barack Obama has begun to do that. I know that he is very popular in that region for his efforts to reach out. His comments in his inaugural address, his subsequent Al Arabiya interview, the fact that he will go to Egypt and speak, that's public diplomacy, folks. That's what we need. But we need more of it all the way down, filtering down, and we need it reinforced by the policies that we adopt underneath it, because you can undo all of that with an Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo or the wrong moves in Afghanistan and so forth. And I think that if we reinvigorate our thoughts about communication within the framework of diplomacy, we're going to do a lot better.
Senator Kerry, yes, I think we have two more questions. I'm charged with protecting the senator's time because he does have to. I think traveling is on the calendar this afternoon. Yes.
I think we have some votes coming up here sometime, which is my
Thank
problem.
Thank you. I'm Nancy Lubin. I'm with J&A Associates, a research and consulting group that focuses on aid in the former Soviet Union. And I'm curious, one of your last points focused on the need to promote accountability and transparency in our programs. And I'm just curious what you have in mind. Are you looking at particular legislative initiatives? Are you looking at more congressional oversight hearings? In which case, on what? Are you looking at institutional changes? But I had in mind both to have more accountability in money not being wasted, but also ensuring that programs that work are continued and those that aren't are.
Well, we're looking at all of the above. I mean, I think I said in my comments to you that if you've got 150 different priorities, you're going to have to pick some of them more effectively. We don't have unlimited resources. We have to do a better job of building with our allies some of the these set of priorities. We're now starting to do that, for instance, in Afghanistan, because through the NATO effort, we've reached out and we're trying to coordinate more effectively who's doing what, how much they can do. The French are going to take more of a role with respect to police training, different the justice system, people are going to be. So we're defining those responsibilities in a multilateral way. That's the beginning of the kind of reform effort we need. So we aggregate the resources that are available to us. We also have promised, and we've put it into the bill, the Kerry Lugar bill on Pakistan, we have benchmarks so that we require the administration to do a very serious measurement of whether or not we're getting any return on that investment. Is it being spent for what we sent it to be spent for? Is it being spent well, effectively, and so forth? We need to look at all of those kinds of questions. There's also an enormous amount of bureaucracy. We have to reduce the bureaucracy. We have to get tough with ourselves. We have to try to figure out how we deliver more for less. And it's doable. Once again, I come to this example of three cups of tea. I mean, Greg Mortensen was building schools at a quarter or less the price that the same effort would have been done under USAID. And he was doing it, getting the local people to do it and invest in it and care about it and therefore help protect it, as opposed to plunk, here we are, plunk it down, there it is, target gets blown up and nobody cares. You know, we got to be smarter about how we go at it. So that's the kind of thing we're going to try to put into the legislation, but also, you know, we want to do it in a way that doesn't create more bureaucracy in and of itself. So balance it. One more.
Time for one more?
Yeah, sure. I have a couple more, I think. Are we okay or not?
Well, it's really one more.
I'm getting the one more hook.
Okay. One more.
Hi, I'm Sam Worthington from Interaction, and we're the largest umbrella of U.S. NGOs, so I appreciate your praise of an NGO's work. And I think one of the realities we've seen since 9/11 is tens of millions of Americans giving of their own dollars to the U.S. NGO community overseas, which has resulted in literally hundreds of thousands of staff on the ground working in Taliban areas and others. So it's a two-part question, because we recognize that development is a long-term process. So how do we relate this long-term process with shorter-term political objectives? And the second part is, how can the U.S. government in this new legislation better partner with groups like the U.S. International Nonprofit or Civil Society?
Well, I think, you know, it's got its risk. I'm going to take the second part first. It's got its risk, but I think if you go to what I was talking about, the field versus Washington, you got to trust some of these folks out there in the field to be able to make their judgment about how they think they're going to do this, and you hold them accountable. If it works, more power to them. If it doesn't work, you know, that's the choice they've made about their career and what they're doing. But that's accountability rather than dictating it from here from a bunch of folks who may have a whole different set of other priorities. I believe, because I've met so many of them traveling around the world, they're savvy. And every time I sit there, I hear a better presentation than what I usually get in Washington about what's happening on the ground and how to respond to it. And I think we have to give that more license and capacity. Yes, you're going to have some failures. And yes, as a result, you know, you're going to make some changes. But I think we're going to get much farther through that kind of initiative. And that also is reinforced, incidentally, by the experience that our Marines had in Anbar province, where they were the ones who discovered the Anbar Awakening. That wasn't discovered by Washington. It wasn't a classified report to the Joint Chiefs of Staff or something. It was the guys on the ground saying, hey, I'm able to work with these guys. We're getting this done. We've built up a relationship. We got some trust here. And then that grew into the understanding that they really had an interest in getting something to protecting their lives, and we learned how to do it. So I think that that's a key way to sort of empower people on the ground. That's how you decide to do it. You're never going to institutionalize an ability to be perfect in deciding what you're going to do and where you're going to invest your money. You're just not going to do it. Now, on the larger question of what you said, how are we going to get people to sort of, you know, understand this commitment? Folks, this is a matter of defining your national security properly from the beginning. We've been through a long period of time where national security has been simplified into slogans, most of which are based on fear, and most of which have been erroneously targeted on translating everything into, quote, the war on terror. And it's been mostly, you know, kinetic. It's been large forces go in with the minute to do this and that. Now, finally, and I think this has been ratified by the change of command in Afghanistan, General McChrystal is, in fact, he's been chosen to do this job because he completely understands the other thing that I was just talking about, how you empower grassroots up, how you find the bad guys without having to have an enormous military footprint to do it, and how you go after them in ways that don't wind up undoing everything else that you're trying to do through the investment you've made on the ground. That's going to be, I hope, a smart application of this that can change the dynamics. And he also understands you've got to get people to take a stake in their community. You've got to re-empower the tribal component of this. One of the things that has just leapt out at me in the last years, mostly because of the nature of our struggle against extremism and the insurgencies that we face, is really the something that America has always overlooked to a great degree, and the British abused, and that is tribalism. And the fact is that these countries are just very, very different culture, different place. Afghanistan has never had, it's had a national identity, Afghanistan, but they never translated that national identity through a Kabul government. They always translated it through their allegiance to the monarch and their own definition as an Afghan, but who controlled their own valley or their own river area or whatever. And the British came along and Lord Durand just drew that line right through the Pashtun. And you get the Pashtun over here in Pakistan, the Pashtun over here in Afghanistan. And we're sitting around saying, well, how do we keep them, how do we get the border to sort of mean? Well, folks, it's never going to mean anything. These are brothers and uncles and cousins and people who've traversed that line for hundreds of years. And what we need to do is sort of communicate publicly in ways and have plans that sort of show the key is to make the border irrelevant. And you make the border irrelevant by making sure the Pashtun on both sides are being satisfied in their empowerment within their communities to make life better for their people. And that means less civilian casualties. It means a whole bunch of other things that we have to do in order to change the dynamics of this counterinsurgency. If we do that, then we have a chance of empowering people. So that's the bigger piece. And you say, how do you do it? We've got to convince Americans that their national security is legitimately at stake in these endeavors, and reconnect them, to come back full circle, to the success of the Marshall Plan. Most people in America, if we had left the Marshall Plan up to the devices of the country, we wouldn't have had it, because the majority of the country was against it. It was presidential leadership that said, we're going to go do this, Harry Truman, they put it in place, and the result was we rebuilt Japan with a constitution, and it's now one of the most reliable allies in the world. We rebuilt Germany and most of Europe, and look at Germany now as a partner in so many different enterprises, you can't count them all. And Germany now, incidentally, is about to have more people working in green technology, alternative renewable energy, than they have working in the automobile industry, because they understand and are applying the very principles we taught them. That's the value of this. And if we can just, you know, the president's got to do this, the Secretary of State's got to do this, we in Congress have to do this, and we need a responsible press that doesn't reduce this to an alternative of either spending money on a bridge in Boston or in, Louisiana or somewhere, but really shows people this is an investment in our long-term security. If you don't want people walking into malls and blowing themselves up, if you don't want, I mean, just today we read about four guys arrested in upstate New York who were planning to bomb some synagogues and who actually bought bombs that they were faked, so therefore no explosion. But they're still plotting out there. And the way to ultimately do that is to strip away the incentive for people to view the United States as the problem. And that's what public diplomacy is all about. Thanks.
Senator Kerry, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing this. And also you're. Thank you so much for sharing this very clear and strong perspective. All the dimensions of the problem, you have an incredible command. I know you have to leave. Your colleagues said you're traveling this afternoon. So thank you very much, and I hope we'll have you back.
Thanks, Kamal.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.